On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
As people may know, it's been the Fine Gael Ordesh for the last 5 days. They're not usually 5 days, but of course, given the COVID times that we're in, there haven't been any physical elements to it, so it's all been conducted online. Yesterday, that culminated with the usual leader's address by the Taoiseach and the Fine Gael leader, Leo Varadkar. After that speech, I sat down with the Taoiseach to ask him about some of the issues that he raised. He started off by discussing his vision for what exactly the future of work is going to look like, given that he is the Minister for Enterprise.
Yeah, well, this Ardesh has really been all about Fine Gael setting out our vision as to what Ireland should look like after the pandemic. And I have a very strong view that we should try and build a better Ireland after this pandemic. It's caused a lot of us to reevaluate what's important to us, a lot of things we want to hang on to that we learned in the pandemic, other things, of course, that we want to forget about. And one thing we definitely see as a party is that the world of work is going to be different post-pandemic. It's going to be a lot more flexible. We want people to have a lot more choice about whether they base themselves in the office, base themselves at home, or perhaps in a hub in a rural town or village. And we see huge benefits for that, both in terms of work-life balance and also in terms of rural development, in terms of reducing emissions from transport. But of course, it involves an engagement involving government, employers and workers as well, because we have to make sure that whatever you do, the work gets done.
Have you got any specific targets in mind or any kind of metrics for how many people might be working fully from home, or if there'll be some sort of a blended option?
Yeah, well, we do in the public sector in the sense that we're saying that at least 20% of people in the public sector should have the option of remote or home working. Some people may think that sounds very low, but if you think about it, huge numbers of people in the public service work in healthcare or work in education. They're teachers or a Gardaí, and it's very hard for them to work from home for obvious reasons. Much easier for government departments, civil service, for example, local authorities. So that's an engagement that we're going to have with unions quite soon. The Department of Public Expenditure is already developing guidelines on that, and that's with a view to return to offices in the kind of August, September period. For the private sector, to a large extent, that's going to be something they're going to have to talk to their employees about. And you see some companies doing it already. Some of the tech companies, for example, are already ahead of that, some of the banks. But I'd encourage employers now to begin that conversation with employees. We don't want things to drift back to the old normal. We have an opportunity now, a golden opportunity, to build a new normal, a better normal. And that's all we'll be talking about that now.
But as the Minister for Enterprise, though, do you have any carrot or any stick that you can wield to try and nudge people into that? Because as you say, if it's up to the private sector and there doesn't appear to be much the government can do to influence their thinking that way, you could still have people drifting back to the old habits of hour-long commutes and 5 days in the office in the city.
Yeah, in terms of incentives, in the next budget there is going to be a package around remote working to facilitate that and encourage that, and you'll see the details of that in October. On the legislative side, I'm going to bring in a new law around the right to request remote working. And that means any employee, once they've been working for a particular employer for a certain period of time, can request remote working. It's not a right to demand remote working, it's a right to request remote working, but an employer will be legally obliged to give that proper consideration and to either say yes or no, and if they say no, to give solid reasons as to why that can't be done, and that can be challenged then in the Workplace Relations Commission.
You've said in the speech, though, that your definition now of what is an essential worker, as everyone has been by the pandemic, it's been blown wide open. Now we know that it's more about retail workers and others who work in services as well. There's all this lofty talk about everyone not having to commute into cities or not having to sit as long in motorways or more rural hubs. But there are so many sectors of the economy that you just can't work from home for, and they might feel like they're being left out of this conversation.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that has changed because of the pandemic is it's caused me and I think a lot of us to reevaluate what an essential frontline worker is. And traditionally we thought of nurses, doctors, paramedics, people in uniform in public sector jobs with pensions, probably on pay above the national average. But now we know it's much broader than that. It's cleaners, it's people who work in food service, it's people who work in supermarkets and retail, drivers, for example. And I want one of the legacies, one of the dividends of this pandemic to be better terms and conditions for them. And we have three things in mind. First of all, statutory sick pay. Most of those workers are private sector. Most of them don't have any right to sick pay. That's going to change. It's going to change from the 1st of January next year if I get the support of the Dáil and Shannon for that, and I believe I will. Second is the move to a living wage. And I've commissioned the Low Pay Commission to begin research on that, and that's underway. And then third is a long-standing Fine Gael policy, but one that we need to make a reality now, and that's the whole idea of auto-enrolment, that everyone will have a pension fund in addition to their state pension. They'll pay into it, their employer will pay into it, the state will pay into it.
There's been talk about that, though, for years. Do we have an actual firm timeline for when that might actually finally happen?
Yeah, so my current timeline is sick pay 2021, well, 2022, I suppose, living wage.
But for the auto-enrolment of pensions?
Yeah, 2023, we would plan to
begin. So in 2 years' time, you'll have the phased-in of automatic pensions and you'd have to opt out?
Yeah, the first contributions we would aim for 2023. Again, something led by Minister Humphreys from her Department of Social Protection. It has been planned for a long time. It was stopped in the past because of the financial crisis. The pandemic probably delayed it, but we're determined to have that up and running before the end of the term of this government.
And what about the living wage? Is there a timetable in mind for that? Because that's going to be a fairly steep increase. If the minimum wage right now is a little over €10 and you might have to increase it to somewhere between 12 and 13, it's a thing that many people will be dependent on, but it's not something you can do overnight.
It's definitely not something you can do overnight. You know, the most important workers' right is the right to work, the right to a job. And we're not going to do anything that we believe would result in people losing their jobs or people seeing their hours cut. That would be totally counterproductive. But if you look at what happened over the past 10 years, you know, under Fine Gael governments, we saw a 25% increase in the minimum wage, seven increases in the past 10 years. So we have a good record on this, one that our opponents never give us credit for, but for people interested in the facts, that's our record. I wouldn't think it would take 10 years. I think we can do it quicker than that. But we have to phase it in, and we also have to work out how we calculate it. There are different groups that have different opinions on how it should be calculated.
Could it be in the lifetime of this government?
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
So you'd hope to have the minimum wage of being a living wage by 2025?
We would certainly want to have it phased in, yeah. And we haven't yet worked out how it's going to be phased in. You know, initially it could be voluntary, or you might give a phase-in period as to where it may be done, and employers, for example, would declare whether or not they pay it, and that may actually affect the way people spend their money, because I think a lot of people, when they go to a shop or a restaurant or spend their money, they would like to know that the person who is facing them is getting the living wage.
The most basic cost of living is obviously keeping the roof overhead, and although you're committing to have this in by the next election, which is 2025, the cost of housing could well go up in the meantime. We've seen the precarious nature of the housing market. It's been a very big political topic in the last couple of months. You're committing in the Ard Fhéidh speech to try and have home ownership at 70% by the end of the decade and 40,000 homes built every year by the end of the year. Your party has been in government now a decade and a month. You haven't come anywhere near your housing construction targets up till now. Why should people have faith that you'll get there this time?
I'll just say our target is to build 40,000 houses a year, not next year, but to get to that point. It's a doubling of where we are now, which is 20,000. But bear in mind that doubling of where we are now, 20,000, it was 5,000 or 6,000 a few years ago. So we have quadrupled the number of new homes being built in the country.
Rebuilding Ireland, your plan from 2016 was supposed to be delivering 25,000 homes a year, and even pandemic aside, it never got there.
We would have got there, but for the pandemic. You know, we were heading for 25,000 last year and 30,000 this year, but because of the pandemic, it's going to be more like 20,000 this year. So, you know, it's just common sense that shutting down construction held us back. It did. I think we would have got to 30,000 this year.
But there's estimates, though, that you need about 33,000 units a year, every year, simply to keep up with demand. So for every year you fall behind 33, that's more of a demand that builds up that you're not catering to. How long will it be before we actually meet the demand year on year, let alone start clawing into the arrears?
Yeah, well that's correct. About 33,000 a year is where we need to be. But the reason why we're setting the target today as a party of 40,000, as we know we'll need to exceed that at a certain point to make up for the demand that has not been supplied. I think it's doable to increase supply by more than 5,000 a year. You know, we have done that under the last government. So, you know, this will be set out obviously in the Housing for All document, which isn't agreed yet, and Mr. Bryan's putting that together.
I was going to ask, have you discussed this target with your other coalition partners? Because it wouldn't be unknown for a party in coalition to make a promise during an Ard Fhéidh or in a high-profile speech like yours last evening, and not to have it cleared with the other departments, including the department that's actually going to be delivering this?
Well, each of the three parties in this government have their own policies, and we're all comfortable with the fact that we have different policies. We're saying we need to get up to 40,000 a year. That's what we're going to feed
into. Discussed it
with them. I have, yeah. We discussed that at a cabinet subcommittee. But it's not government policy. You're right about that. This is Fine Gael policy. But we will feed that into housing for all, which will be government policy when it's agreed.
40,000 homes every year, if delivered, would obviously be a huge help. But affordability would still be a major problem. And there's still a lot of people who are very aggrieved about the government's action on cuckoo funds a few weeks back, where it decided to levy an extra stamp duty on the mass purchase of houses, but not of apartments. If so many of the 40,000 homes that might be built every year in the future are apartments, what guarantee is there that regular income people will ever be able to afford them?
Well, you know, I think at the heart of the solution to the housing crisis is supply. It's building more homes of all sorts, houses, apartments, social, affordable, cost rental, private houses for purchase. But building won't do it on its own. You know, we will need to do other things. I think we'll need more action to protect renters, for example. I think we'll need to do more things to help first-time buyers to get a deposit and get a mortgage. So, you know, this is a complex problem. It requires all sorts of different solutions. In relation to the whole issue on stamp duty, you know, we made that decision for a particular reason, and that was that the experts and people involved in housing construction were saying to us that if we imposed that stamp duty on apartments, those apartments just wouldn't be built. It's expensive to build apartments for lots of different reasons, and without that forward purchase agreement, you'd have fewer apartments being built. So that's always the thing you have to bear in mind when it comes to any policy.
But apartments are effectively the only building in a lot of urban areas. You have a by-election candidate right now talking about a 15-minute city. That sort of depends on people being able to afford living in some of those urban environments. And if those people are always going to be outbid by a cuckoo fund, what hope do they have?
Yeah, well, you know, they won't be, and you probably saw some.
Why wouldn't they be?
Well, if you want to know the facts at the moment, for example, only came out the other day, you probably saw it, the breakdown of new homes and who bought them in the past year. More than half of new homes bought in the past year were bought either by owner-occupiers or first-time buyers. Only about 10% were bought by investment funds, 20% by the state through approved housing bodies. So this perception that investment funds are buying up all the houses is incorrect. It's about 10%. It'll probably be less now because of the actions that we've taken. But if you take, for example, somewhere like Dublin Bay South, you know, the whole idea there, and something that James Gagan is strongly supporting, all candidates are not, is the building of a whole new suburb in Poolbeg, thousands of new houses. And of course, in those houses, there will be affordable purchase houses as part of that scheme.
Can I talk about a few other contemporary issues? There seems to be a lot of confusion at the moment around the government's stance on international travel and the role of antigen testing. From the middle of July, your government will be allowing people to go abroad if they're fully vaccinated and they can return as long as they have a negative PCR test. The chief medical officer, though, is telling people not to go abroad unless they're fully vaccinated. Surely there's a disconnect there between what the government is saying and what the government's own medical advisor is saying.
Well, you know, it wouldn't be the first time or only time that the public health advice from the doctors, from the CMO, is not necessarily going to be the same as the policy of government or what we put into law. What Tony Hoolan is saying is entirely understandable from a public health point of view and a scientific point of view. It is much safer if we only allowed people who are fully vaccinated to travel. Mm. You know, if you're fully vaccinated, and I mean fully vaccinated,
both doses are one
in the cases of the J&J vaccine, you're very unlikely to pick up the virus and therefore very unlikely to transmit it to other people when you return home. That's not the case if you're not fully vaccinated. But we think it'd be unfair to say to families and to say to younger people who haven't had the opportunity to get vaccinated yet because we haven't had the supply, to say to them that you can't travel abroad. And that's why we're putting in very strict rules, which is the requirement of a PCR test before you return to the country.
Why are we requiring
that's why that is the case.
A PCR test when you return to the country, when almost every other country in the European Union will be happy to accept an antigen test? And that's particularly salient if you go abroad and you happen to be unlucky enough to contract COVID while you're there. An antigen test, once you've had COVID and you've recovered from it, will prove that you're not infectious. But if you contract COVID while you're abroad, you could still be failing a PCR test for weeks. You could be stranded abroad, potentially with your family, unable to come home and resume your life.
I wouldn't say almost every other European country. It's quite a mix when you actually look at what different countries are doing. And some are on the stricter side like us. Some, particularly those that have a big economy based on tourism, like the Mediterranean countries, are more
liberal.
But
you describe ours as the stricter side. Why are we on the stricter side?
Because we want to reduce the risk of new variants entering and taking hold in this country before we've ever been vaccinated. And we've had experience of that last Christmas and last January, and we don't want a repeat of that. So that's why we're being stricter.
Do you not believe that many other European countries who are happy with the use of antigen tests have that same fear?
I think they do, but I think the calculation is different for them because they're not island nations by and large. We have one land border, they have many land borders, and it's different when most people arrive in your country by train or car than by plane, you know, for obvious reasons. And one thing I would say about antigen testing, and I'm a supporter of antigen testing, I think it has a role to play. I'm encouraging businesses to take it up. Antigen testing is really good at detecting people who are in that infectious stage. But the difficulty is that you could, for example, contract the virus on a Monday, test negative on antigen test on the Tuesday, get on the plane, test again negative when you arrive, and by Wednesday or Thursday you're shedding the virus and infecting people. On Monday the PCR test probably would have picked it up. So I know it's more expensive and I know it's less convenient, but it will pick up more positives.
One other issue that I'd like to discuss with you before we let you go is the future of the National Maternity Hospital. The government had portrayed a fairly calm approach to all of this and didn't seem to acknowledge that there were many concerns around the governance or what might be offered inside that hospital. You in the Dáil on Thursday then acknowledged that there were some concerns. How long have you had those concerns for?
Well, this has been ongoing for years. I can't remember exactly when the hospital got planning permission, but I think it might have been 2016, 2017, 2018. So, you know, there have been negotiations going on for years.
But there had been very high profile announcements by the Sisters of Charity and by your own government at the time, yourself and your then Health Minister, Simon Harris, about golden shares and governance arrangements. And it seemed as if that had all been put to bed in the government's eyes.
Well, I think we're thereabouts. You know, the decision of the Sisters of Charity to withdraw from healthcare to give the land to a charity is very significant. And I want to respect the fact that they have made that decision. Some people are giving them a lot of abuse at the moment. I think that's a little bit unfair when you look at the facts. We have an agreement that the hospital will be publicly owned. We have an agreement that any obstetric or gynecological procedure that's legal in the state, including terminations of pregnancy, IVF, will be legal in the new hospital. We're comfortable around that. We have two difficulties. One is around the governance, the makeup of the board. We don't like that there are no representatives of the government on the board as is currently proposed. And secondly, an issue around the land that the hospital will be built on, because that's intended to be a long-term lease. We are now hearing that, I think I'm now hearing that that either Vincent's or the sisters may be willing to sell that land, and if they are, we're willing to buy.
You are willing to buy it if they're willing to sell it?
Yeah.
Is there a price ceiling on that?
Absolutely not going to get into that, as you can imagine.
But you can understand
any commercial
you can understand
land transaction.
Why it's a salient issue, though, because if there is already apparently a legal guarantee that all legal procedures will be offered, then people will wonder why would the state have to spend tens or potentially hundreds of millions of euro buying land to guarantee independence that, in fact, it already has.
Well, I do think the issue of the land ownership is being elevated by people to a higher extent than maybe it needs to be for reasons that you said.
Is it salient? Is there a prospect that a hospital which is built on land owned by a religious charity could still find itself unable to carry out all those procedures?
I don't believe that would be an issue, but there may be other issues. You'll be familiar with the fact that St. Vincent's mortgaged the public hospital and the land it's on in order to build a private hospital. I would have a difficulty with the idea that the land that we're leasing for the new hospital might be mortgaged. These are the kind of things, maybe I'm making too big a deal of it, but
it's not necessarily about the procedures that are operated within the hospital, it's more just about the legalities of who owns the land and who can claim the land.
Yes, but also the governance piece is important too, because boards make decisions and we would like to have government reps on a board for obvious reasons, and that's probably more important than the lease arrangement. But I would say this, and you know, I think some people aren't acknowledging this. You know, Hallow Street, the National Maternity Hospital, is a Catholic ethos hospital. At least on paper, the chairman of the board is the Archbishop of Dublin, although he wants to come off that. Notwithstanding that, Hallow Street is a hospital in which terminations are performed, in which assisted reproduction is provided. So, you know, I think sometimes people can take this issue a little bit further than the facts would allow. And I worked there. You know, I did part of my training in the National Maternity Hospital. I never, ever felt that there was a nun or a priest looking over my shoulder when it came to giving the right care to women or to neonates.
You do have a situation, though, where you do have one former master in Peter Boylan who says that the religious influence is material and salient, and then you have another master, Rona Mahoney, who says that it's not. For people who are attending the protest, which is planned for this next Saturday, can you and the government assure them that when this hospital is up and running, whenever that may be, that it will absolutely be carrying out all clinical procedures as are provided by law and not just whatever a religion is happy with?
Yes, absolutely, just as it does now.